Japan finds out who its new prime minister is, and it's who pretty much everyone expected. The BBC, of all institutions, decides that the age of the specialist radio reporter is over, and a new addition to Italy's newsstands. Monocle's editors tackle those topics today on the late edition here on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to the late edition. I'm Andrew Muller. I'm joined today by Monocle's Chris Chermack and Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Chris, you've actually been somewhere, which is incredibly exciting in this day and age, to the extent that I got incredibly excited earlier today by having lunch with somebody who lives in Twickenham and was regaling me of tales of life in far off Zone 4 or wherever it is in West London. But you've actually been on a plane that went over different countries, although in fairness to arrive in more or less the one we're in.
I went on a plane over different countries to arrive in the same country, that being Gibraltar, which was a fantastic little trip, and I would say a bit of a loophole, if you will, because we were considering countries that would not require us to quarantine when we returned to the UK. So, you know, in some ways, aside from it being a holiday, I also thought it pointed out a bit of the fallacy of the way that this is being done with quarantines on borders, because you can go to this one southern tip of Spain, and that's totally fine, but you can't enter Spain. If we had crossed the border, supposedly we would have had to quarantine when we returned here.
Have they put up a sign at that weird little frontier on the other side of the airport facing into Spain saying virus unwelcome?
No, they have not. No, they actually still have the border pretty freely open, surprisingly. Apparently, all you have to do is sort of wave a passport in the general direction of a border guard and you cross. There were anecdotal stories there that you could also wave a diary and you would still get across the border.
Fernando, should we ask Chris to sit further away?
It's okay. You know, I'm actually curious about Gibraltar. You know, never been.
On that point, just to say, interestingly, Gibraltar has tested its entire population. They have tested more people than they have on. They have done more tests than they have people on the island, which is about 35,000 peninsula, I should say.
Maybe Chris is the one that should avoid us, Andrew.
Well, exactly. That's how I feel.
I mean, I have been to Gibraltar a couple of times on assignment for this magazine. It is a weird little place, but I do quite like it. It is spectacular. The people are sort of determined and combative, and the views off the southern tip across the water to Africa are astonishing.
The views are astonishing. It's a beautiful little place. It was nice and warm. And yes, it's very interesting, the difference in culture compared to the UK, I felt. Even though it is British, everyone speaks Spanish. So there's this sort of multilingual cultural element that you don't quite experience in the UK otherwise. So it was a nice change.
I enjoyed the confluence of really old, like everyone seems to have really old school English names. Like everyone's called Winston or Edith or Agnes or Albert, but there's usually a Spanish surname on the end of it.
Thrown in.
We will move along, however, from Gibraltar before we start talking about the monkeys, because once we do that, then the next 25 minutes just vanish. And we will start in Japan, which does have a new prime minister. As was confidently expected by everybody, the ruling Liberal Democratic Party has replaced the outgoing Shinzo Abe with Yoshihide Suga. Mr. Suga is 71 years old, was a long-standing ally of Abe, and is expected to carry on more or less as Abe already was, which is to say that something in politics has occurred which seems orderly, normal, and predictable, and it now seems pretty weird to think there was a time when people complained about that. Here is Monocle's Tokyo bureau chief, Fiona Wilson.
Shinzo Abe had he had ideological positions that are very well known, you know, these nationalist positions, very concerned to reformulate the constitution, Japan's pacifist constitution. He wanted to change that. Now, really, Suga is not one to go on about nationalism in any shape or form. He's very pragmatic, and everyone says the same thing. He doesn't have a lot of charm, sorry to say, but that's the verdict on him. You know, when he goes into a room, he's not dominating the room, radiating charisma. He looks at the small print, and he's not really one for schmoozing, but he wants to get things done. And that's where he will differ from Shinzo Abe. But I don't think he'll be grandstanding on the diplomatic front.
Fernando, you come from one of these countries, which is now run by one of these exciting, unorthodox, iconoclastic politicians who has no respect for tradition or decorum or the way that things have always been done. Are you quite excited about the idea of a dull, forgettable technocrat in charge just, you know, doing stuff?
Listen, everything would be better than the current president we have. But Andrew, but I do have to tell you, I mean, charisma is important, actually, in politics. Not the type of charisma that perhaps Trump or Bolsonaro or lack of charisma for
or
some.
Or indeed Boris Johnson.
Exactly. But the interesting thing from what I've been reading about Suga, I mean, Fiona, she rightly said that, you know, he doesn't have charm, that perhaps he's not going to be as charismatic in the world stage as Shinzo Abe. But he's the son of strawberry farmers. And I wonder if that little background story as well might compensate his lack of charisma. Because, you know, he doesn't come from the traditional Japanese elite background that most politicians have.
Shinzo Abe comes from a political dynasty on both sides of his family.
Exactly. So I wonder, yes, though, but, you know, has an kind of an interesting backstory that could help.
See, Chris, I am heartily in favour myself of tedious technocrats whose presence in their office you actually forget about most of the time. I am one of those people who would be very content to rarely hear from the people running the country or indeed about them.
That's a fair point. But, you know, I really do struggle with this concept, if I'm honest. My prism is more looking at, for example, through Europe. And it's tricky, isn't it? Because, yes, on the one hand, you want a technocrat to run a country because they are the most effective at running a country. But at the end of the day, we do live in a democracy. And if you do not have the people with you, if you are not an effective communicator at what you do, you are going to invite a populist, somebody else, to come in who can connect with people on a different level, if you will, than you can as a technocrat. And it won't matter how effective you are at running the government. And I think we've seen that in some cases. In politics today. On a flip side, I have to say, reading also about Suga, I was reminded of an early Angela Merkel in Germany when I was there, because she was an interesting case, perhaps to make the opposite argument of the one I just made. That she was somebody who was seen as not particularly charismatic when she first took when she first became head of the Conservatives in Germany. She was not charismatic. She was seen as not really somebody with strong leadership qualities. She barely won an election in order to become chancellor against Gerhard Schröder. And then she found her way into the role, right? And then she became a leader as it came on, partly because she was effective. That's how she found her voice. She was a pragmatist. She stood by her decisions. She stood by what she wanted to do. She took some quite bold decisions, whether that was, you know, a green revolution in Germany, abandoning nuclear power. So she took some quite striking decisions along the way that surprised many people, precisely because she was seen as this sort of quiet person that nobody really assumed would be a strong personality. So you do have to wonder if someone like Suga might also grow into the role a little bit. And if he can demonstrate that he is making progress in the country, maybe he can convert that into popular support.
I completely agree with Chris here, because, you know, even with Angela Merkel, I mean, of course, she was never the most charismatic. But I think even in recent years, I kind of feel that actually she can be indeed charismatic. Her eye rolls for me make her a very interesting figure for me, you know, in a way. So maybe Suga will learn as well to be a little bit more fun in a way.
Just one more quick thought on this, Chris, because the comparison with Germany is interesting in that these are two countries which both had to find a way in the world after being basically the bad guy in World War II. And what you say about flashy politicians is interesting in the context of Germany, because I've spoken to German politicians and diplomats and journalists many times who've said variations on the thing that we still can't have any flashy politicians in Germany. We're not there yet. It makes people, uncomfortable. Anybody with, like, I remember someone once saying you couldn't even imagine a German equivalent of a Nicolas Sarkozy, rising to high office in Germany. Whereas Shinzo Abe did have ideas about wanting to normalize Japan as a nation and for it to have a normal nation's defense force and presence on the world stage. Was he right about that, do you think?
Well, it's interesting to one of Fiona's points in that he was somebody who wanted to change the pacifist constitution, but he didn't have the people with him. So that also, again, goes to this question of sort of if you're an ideologue but without popular backing, that also doesn't work particularly well. And the same goes in a way with Germany. You have to be in step, I think, with the people. And so, yes, I think German politicians do tend to be more show more of an air of competence than flashiness, perhaps. Although I would say that has changed to some degree. I mean, Gerhard Schröder before Angela Merkel
Fair
was
enough.
Quite media friendly and quite, you know, quite the showman, I would argue. He wasn't, you know, a populist in the way that we you know populists now. But he was certainly of that sort of new, sort of Clinton-esque generation. So we're seeing some of that come out of Germany as well.
Okay, well, let's look a bit closer to home, both geographically and thematically. Here in the UK, the BBC plans to ask all its national radio reporters to apply for a smaller number of less specialised jobs, broadcasting across television and the digital sphere, as well as in audio. Here is Monocle's Chiara Ramella.
This is a report that's come out on The Observer here in the UK over the weekend, claiming that the BBC plans to ask its audio reporters to, I guess, reapply and change their position into more kind of cross-media reporters, so to work for TV, radio, as well as being digital reporters at the same time as well. And the concern, I guess, is that you lose a bit of the authenticity and the intimacy as well of just having people who are dedicated radio reporters. A certain level of cross-media ability is sometimes to be welcomed. You know, we do it here at Monocle. But I think at a time when people have rediscovered the importance of radio and the intimacy of recognizing these voices who have accompanied them sometimes for months on end, it's a strange thing to choose to do, to, I guess, cut back on the importance of radio and instead redirect somewhere else.
Fernando, what do you think of this? Does a specialist radio reporter lose something, some bond with their audience, if they are seen to be broadcasting or journalising in other spheres?
Yes, I would say so. I mean, first of all, versatility in journalism is something that we've been learning, I think, all of
Absolutely.
Us here. And I mean, it is necessary in a way, but perhaps not as much. I mean, this report, if it is true indeed, it's quite shocking. Basically, in the report, it says that all radio journalists would have to reapply for their jobs. I mean, sure, some of them, they can, you know, work with TV or with print. You know, that's kind of natural. But you know, I do think if you excel sometimes in your job, perhaps as a radio journalism, I think there's no need for you to, you know, to go to other kind of methods. I don't think there should be a rule for everyone, if you know what I mean. And if this report is true indeed, I think it's an exaggeration from the part of the BBC to do that. But I mean, we have to wait and see if that report can be held to account as well.
And Chris, it's always quite difficult to properly scrutinise the entrails whenever the BBC announces some grand new plan of this sort. The organisation does often seem to be in a state of preemptively panicking, trying to second guess whatever the government is of the day is trying to cause it to do or stop doing. But we'll get to that shortly, but as an idea in itself, are they entirely wrong in suggesting that maybe the era of the specialist journalist might be over? I mean, as Fernando was saying, I mean, most of the people in this building try their hands at various things, whether it's writing, broadcasting, making films, and certainly having been winging it myself as a journalist for a very long time now, I have found myself and still find myself, you know, doing things and learning to do new things that I wouldn't ever have dreamt I would have been doing not all that long previously.
I think that's true. We're all, as you've both said, learning to be more versatile. But perhaps I would take this from a slightly different perspective as a former, or still, but a print journalist. Mm. When I was in Berlin in my last job for Handelsblatt, we were launching an English publication, for just one example. We tried everything, right? We tried to get out there on radio. We tried to do Facebook Live broadcasts, these kinds of things to try and be new and fresh. And I have to say, not just us, but you see this when groups like, I don't know, the Washington Post or the Atlantic or certain groups, you know, my perspective also in the U.S., try to go into radio as print journalists. And it just doesn't work very well, because if you don't have that expertise, if you don't have either the voice or a bit of training or the people around you that can guide you, I think that does make a big difference. So when I was in Berlin, as I said, I tried to do a Facebook Live. I was on air for like 2 hours trying to do a Bundestag, like a parliamentary hearing into the Volkswagen diesel scandal. And we sat there for 3 hours outside the courtroom broadcasting. It was an awful experience for somebody who had no broadcast training before that. And if I had been guided, you know, and that I have to say, not to toot our own horn, if you will, but coming into Monocle, into a group of actual, you know, radio reporters, where there is this tradition of radio reporting that has been built up, it's helped me to find my own voice in radio in a way that I don't think you can do otherwise. So yes, versatility is fine, but some people excel at it, some people don't, and you need to have the right environment. So I'd be worried if you're going to lose that by cutting the amount of pure radio expertise that you have within the BBC or anywhere else.
Because the thing that concerns me about this, Fernando, is that some people are just not by inclination or by nature generalists. There are people in journalism, as in many other fields, who can do one thing really extremely incredibly well, but not so much at others. I've heard many tales of people, in fact, at least one I can recall, the person who told me about this was the person themselves, a radio broadcaster of years and years of experience who was asked to do an audition to do news camera TV stuff. And they said, yeah, they stuck a camera in my face, me who has been broadcasting for a living for years, and I froze. Just couldn't say a thing. Could not talk into a camera to save myself. In front of a microphone in a studio, fine, all day. In fact, that's what I do for a living, but I couldn't do it on TV at all. And that would be a loss if you just lost people who had a particular block about one means of communication.
I completely agree with you, Andrew. I think I prefer to be excellent in a few things than average in everything. I mean, I would hire the excellent one in a few things than the average one, you know? I mean, you know, you're going to lose talent if you expect someone to be, you know, technical, to be a voice on the radio and here and there. I think you're expecting a bit too much from those journalists. So it did worry me a little bit reading that report. I actually have a feeling that it might not go ahead. I mean, at all national reporters, that's a bit too much. I would be very, very shocked. If that goes ahead.
That tawdry, unworthy thought did occur to me as well, that perhaps this story has been floated by somebody in the BBC who sees this coming and is trying to stir up enough public outrage about the idea that they don't have to go ahead and do it, which does kind of prompt my next question, Chris, was does this strike you, because I mean, I've lived in this country a long time and I still haven't quite figured out what the BBC's relationship with the government, the people, or indeed itself even is. But it does seem to have this perpetual siege mentality. And I'm just wondering if maybe there's a case that it's past time that the BBC just started asserting itself and just saying, look, we are good for this country. We are a good thing for the people who live here. We are a good thing for the image of the United Kingdom overseas. Maybe leave us alone and let us do our job.
Oh, God, that's a good question. It's a hard one to answer. Yes, maybe they could be a little more assertive. But at the same time, I think, you know, they are reliant to a large degree on public funds. So they do have that.
Public funds, which are, of course, paid.
Paid by us in the form of a tax, if you will. But it still means that they have a certain responsibility to the country. And, you know, whether it's the German state broadcasters or NPR in the United States, I mean, I think all of them feel this sort of dual pressure, if you will, to, on the one hand, yes, you stand up for yourself, but standing up for yourself also means almost, as you say, if this article was perhaps placed, to kind of provide the warning signs anytime you feel that your funding might be cut or that you're in trouble in that way, to sort of drum up support for what you do and remind people, I think. So I do think it's important in that sense for the BBC or other state broadcasters have to make this effort, I think, to remind people of the value that they do bring to a nation, and that it is important to have something that is, in a way, impartial, in a way that private media, when I look at, you know, TV in the US, for example, just doesn't really have.
Okay, well, let's move finally along to more cheerful media news, perhaps, which is a new print newspaper in Italy. The tycoon Carlo De Benedetti has announced plans to launch Domani. And here is an excerpt from his interview with Monocle's editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé.
Paper is still very important, the paper edition. So we are just starting on an opposite way as traditional newspaper has done. Traditional newspaper, for reasons which are linked to their heritage, started all with a printing edition and then added to their printing edition a digital version or a website. We are proceeding exactly in the opposite way. Our success is going to depend on how many digital subscribers we are going to have, not how many paper copies we are going to sell. Our model, from that point of view, is completely new. There is no other publication that I know which has started digitally with a paper presence instead of the opposite.
Fernando, that interview in full is on the most recent edition of The Stack?
Yes, and also on The Chiefs, which is okay. Where our editor-in-chief speaks to, you know, world leaders from across the world.
There's a clue in the title. what do we know about domani, which my extremely limited command of Italian tells me is Italian for tomorrow?
Exactly. I think it's quite an exciting launch. The first edition...
It's a ballsy name for a newspaper.
Absolutely. And you know, the first issue comes out tomorrow, so you can find the newspaper.
It comes out literally domani.
Exactly. That's a very good one. and it'll be available in about 5,000 edicolas in Italy. And I think it's quite interesting that, of course, we have a big digital presence. But I think Carlo De Benedetti, I mean, he has experience in the world of newspapers.
Indeed so.
He's a former publisher of La Repubblica. So, of course, he knows that the paper version is also very important. And he also wants to make this newspaper kind of the liberal newspaper of choice in Italy, because he complains that, you know, some of the newspapers in Italy, they're heavily, they're owned by billionaires who have their own agenda. And he wants Domani to be a little bit different. He says that after 2 years, it will transform itself into a foundation. So we have a different business model. But of course, this is only after 2 years. But I'm very curious how it feels like to read Domani. And, you know, it's always good news when you have a new newspaper on the newsstand as well.
Chris, what do we understand about the gap in the market he thinks he's going to fill? As Fernando says, it's a liberal newspaper, or he will style it a liberal newspaper. Is it just me, or does that in itself seem like a novelty? It feels like every media launch I read about is, because it has been talked about here in the United Kingdom recently, a sort of frothing at the mouth, head-banging right-wing news station, because that's gone really well in the US. Is there like gaps in the liberal media which are desperately aching to be plugged?
I don't know, to be honest, if there are real gaps in the media. I think that's something that, you know, again, from my perspective, looking at the US, for example, I think it has become something of a business ploy, I would argue, ever more in these days than it used to be. To sort of declare that there is a gap where there might not have been one before. But by announcing yourself, by identifying your politics, that has actually been quite effective in recent years. And, you know, I have to say, to take maybe the slight opposite point here, I do think there's, you know, there's some concern in that, because I feel like more and more our media is looking to self-identify itself in terms of where it stands. And I think that fits with the increasing polarization that you see in the United States and in many other countries. And again, to stay with the United States, I think what's been interesting for me to watch, say, something like Fox News and the evolution. Often when it starts, there's a positive reason for it, you could argue. There was perhaps a gap in conservative views in the United States in the 90s when Fox News started, because there was a view that many of the more mainstream media outlets had perhaps unconscious bias towards the left, and so they founded something quote-unquote conservative. But it didn't stop with simply having a conservative voice. It sort of slowly over the years went further and further and further and further to the right in order to distinguish itself from others. So that would be one question for me for Italy as well. What are they when they say they're the liberal sort of voice? What does that mean? Will they stay center-left? Will they slowly feel that they have to continue to self-identify and therefore push themselves further to the left? Will they get pressure from their readers? Like in the US, you got pressure from listeners of Fox News to kind of keep pushing further and further to the right. Will that happen in Italy as well? And does that then mean that you kind of abandon the traditional ways of doing media that I think are important? The fact-checking, the researching, everything to make sure that a story is entirely accurate and that you're not putting a purposeful bias on it and putting a spin on a story that really doesn't quite fit with the facts.
Just a final quick thought on this, Fernando. What sense did you glean from that interview about the motivations behind Domani and what Mr. De Benedetti is doing? Does he have a genuinely pure-hearted desire to broaden the spectrum of discourse, or is he, and this has been something he's spent quite a lot of time, energy and money doing over the years, just trying to think of new ways to annoy Silvio Berlusconi?
Well, yes, and that's a good thing.
I'm not saying that is not a meritorious deployment of his resources.
But you know, you can sense that, you know, he's a passionate man, an acute businessman as well. And I think, you know, he understands that there's still more space for a newspaper in Italy. And I think, liberal or not, I think it is good news that we're there's a new launch in newspapers. And I've been hearing so many positive stories from other countries as well. There's the newspaper Público in Portugal. I mean, rising circulation. And again, even when I look at the papers from Brazil or from the UK or the US, the ones I'm more used to read, they are back. The pages are back because, of course, during lockdown, the papers were quite slimmed down. There were no supplements. All the supplements are getting back. So it's not that the coronavirus devastated the whole industry, as some people like to exaggerate. This didn't happen. There's still space. People like to read papers. The advertisers are slowly coming back. So, you know, I'm just trying to be a little positive here.
That is all for today's late edition. A big thank you to Chris Chermak and Fernando Augusto Pacheco in London, to all our editors today, and to our studio managers, David Stevens and Sam Impey. I'm Andrew Mullett here in London. On the subject of entrepreneurs and enterprise, there is a new edition of Monocle's annual The Entrepreneurs on a newsstand near you, either now or very, very soon indeed. Goodbye and thank you for listening.